When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Beer Ladies Podcast. I'm Lisa, and I am your host today, and I am ably guided by Christina, Carolyn, and Sarah. Hello, ladies.
Hello.
Hi. Hey.
And we will be talking about prohibition today. Enormous topic. We're not going to cover everything, so just want to set some expectations there. But before we dive in, I do want to remind everyone that you can watch us on YouTube. You can subscribe to us everywhere you get your podcast. Like, subscribe, rate, review. It really, really, really does help us get the word out there. So we really appreciate it. So thank you, everyone. So with that said, prohibition, again, huge, huge, huge topic. So before we dive in, we'll sort of, I'll sort of set the scene. We're going to talk a little bit about what leads up to prohibition. We're going to tell some prohibition-related stories, but we are by no means going to cover every single aspect of prohibition. There's just so much to talk about, so many great books out there, so many great documentaries you could watch. So we're just going to touch on a few things that I think maybe perhaps things people don't necessarily know off the bat, or if you do, it's going to be a little bit of revision. So just, you know, kick back, have a drink. So speaking of drinks, let's start. Christina, what are you drinking?
Well, in the spirit, as it were, of prohibition, I am drinking a non-alcoholic beer. So so Beer reached out to me and asked if they could send me some beer. So they did. And so this is their non-alcoholic light lager. And I really actually quite like this. So I really enjoy this. Lisa actually suggested that it kind of tastes like a Mexican light lager. And I completely agree. And so she said to add a lime to it. So I have added a lime to it today. And let me tell you, it's very nice.
Yeah, there you go. Pro tip.
Yeah, very into non-alcoholic non-alcoholic beer to drink sort of in between alcoholic beer to minimize those pesky hangovers, which, you know, the older I get, the worse they are.
Very, very good point. And Carolyn, I know it's early where you are, so you may not be kicking back with, you know, a 10% beer or a crazy cocktail, but what do you got going on?
I am drinking gin from Still Austin Whiskey Company. I'm drinking it with club soda, and it's pretty good. It has good flavor to it.
Excellent. And we will certainly talk a little bit about Prohibition's effect on cocktails and how they how we sort of ended up with the variety we have today. Obviously not going to get too deep into it because, again, that could be an entire podcast, and we'll put some things in the show notes that I think are good for that. But Sarah, what you drinking?
I'm also the voice of the temperance movement today. I'm just having a normal cup of Irish tea.
Which one?
The one from Lidl that's really cheap. Because okay, I don't really like it that much. I can't remember the name of it. But my husband behind me is drinking this counts because I had a sip of it before. So a Black's Brewery Pineapple Express High IPA. Sorry. Oh, okay. There we go.
Excellent. Very
it was quite
good.
Pineapple-y, and he likes it. I think it was a little too pineapple-y for me, but yeah, I'm going to stick to my tea for today.
Nothing wrong with that. And so I've got a Dea Tappy Pills. This is a British lager, and this is actually really, really lovely. I tried to go out and find an equivalent of a sort of pre-prohibition American lager, was unsuccessful, couldn't even find an anchor steam in the kind of time I had. But this is really nice, and I'll for those who are listening, I'll also sort of show. It's a very, very light, crisp lager. Most pre-prohibition American lagers would not have been this light. A lot of them would have been darker. We'll talk a little bit more about that, but I think perfect segue. I've written an article about this in the past, but I'm going to throw over to Christina to say, how do we get here? What happened? So to set the scene a little bit, like a lot of bad ideas, it starts rooted in other bad ideas. So Christina, over to you. Tell us what happened in the 1840s that made everything just kind of set the scene for decades of nonsense.
Well, the 1840s, well, that's going back. So the temperance movement originally started out, and it wasn't, it was more of a moderate movement in the beginning. It wasn't necessarily advocating for the complete abolition of like all alcohol in general, but just the like a significant reduction. And it was originally supported by people sort of across the board, originally. This isn't that last very long. So for example, Frederick Douglass actually was one of the people that attacked it, and said that they failed to make room sort of for Black people within the movement. Mm-hmm. And it sort of did not engage with the abolition of slavery, because there were lots of people in the South who supported the movement. Completely unacceptable by any stretch of the imagination. And so we kind of see a sort of division there. But, you know, it is a process of becoming more and more virulently to the movement that we see kind of now. It does start moderate, and it gets more and more and more and more and more and more until it's complete prohibition. And they want a complete removal of alcohol from the U.S. And I'll slide it back to Lisa. But when I come back, I will talk about how racist, anti-immigrant, anti-Semitic the prohibition movement ends up.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's a really, really important thing to note, is that it's an incredibly white movement when we start getting into the really hardcore temperance stuff. And it actually remains today. The Women's Christian Temperance Union is still a going concern. It is very, very, very white. It is all very much tied into this sort of missionary sort of roots, if you like, but it's a whole thing, and they still, again, look them up, they do some crazy stuff still. But yeah, it is interesting that, again, to your point, a lot of this comes out of this very, you know, nativist movement, which, again, ironic name for what it was. But it's you know, so it's to go sort of go back to the 1840s, which, again, not the only one, but it's a nice one to sort of link onto, because you have a lot of German immigrants coming to the U.S. starting in the 1840s, especially after 1848, when, you know, let's be real, shit got real all across Europe in sort of 1848 and the sort of years before and after. But all of the Germans turn up, and it becomes this very specifically anti-German, and then a little bit later anti-Irish as well, but it's anti-Catholic overall is one of the big things that's driving a lot of this from a political point of view. And curious to throw to Sarah and Carolyn, like, I feel like this is left out when you hear the kind of popular narratives about prohibition. You kind of get your gangsters and you get, you know, things like that. But, you know, did you guys learn any of that at school, or did was it all just sort of like, and then we didn't have booze? Just curious.
I took AP US history in college, and I'm trying to go back. I don't think, yeah, I did very well in that class.
I don't remember them being like, this is like exactly what happened. Cause, you know, for school, like, they take out a lot of information. Good and bad.
Like you said, Lisa, this is like a massive piece of history with a lot of different contexts and absolutely angles that you could approach it. So in high school, probably prohibition is like, maybe you talk, yeah, about it one day out of the week, yeah, and that's it. Yeah. You move on.
This
you
is got what so happened. Much,
we got to get to World War II.
Yeah,
yeah,
exactly.
This is what happened. We had no booze.
Those 13 years go very quickly. And I think it's, and again, it's interesting to be looking back on it now, where, you know, you had a society then that would have just come out of, you know, a terrible world war, a terrible pandemic. And instead of having, like, you know, booze you could go to, it's like, oh, sorry, none of that for you. But of course, the reality is, it's still everywhere. But that's actually something we can do a little bit of myth busting about, too, because most people are following the law, even if they think it's dumb, but, you know, at the same time, that's not kind of the, you know, the sort of image we get of it. But I don't know, Kristen, if you want to talk about whether like the Chicago beer riot or some of those things that lead up to this.
Yeah. So I'm just going to talk a bit about how racist it was and how anti-immigrant it was, and some of the examples sort of about what it is. And so the first article that obviously, I just want to throw it out there. If you have JSTOR, find Prohibition, Racism, and Class Politics in the Post-Reconstruction South by Denise Hurd. I really, really highly recommend that. And that's sort of like preliminary reading to sort of what I'm going to get into a bit now. So the first article that I'm going to sort of skim and summarize is by Christine Sismono, What Prohibition Teaches Us About Race Relations in the U.S. So, and she says, and I think this is very clear, that the prohibition movement essentially sanctioned white terrorism and established mass incarceration in the name of religion. And I think this is really true. And unfortunately, I do think this does get completely sort of swept under the rug. And again, from her article, she says, quote, as renowned lawyer Clarence Darrow famously said in 1924, quote, I would not say that every anti-saloon leaguer is a Ku Kluxer, but every Ku Kluxer is an anti-saloon leaguer. Mm-hmm. So just so you have an idea of how infiltrated by white supremacy and white terrorist organizations, the prohibition movement was. It was, and the White Christian Temperance Union. These become movements of the Ku Klux Klan and white supremacy. This is what prohibition is. And they're not just attacking African Americans. They are attacking immigrants. They're attacking Catholics. It's anti-Semitic in nature. This is, besides all of us who like alcohol, this is a very dangerous movement. So one of the examples that Christine Sismono talks about is the Atlanta race riots in 1906. So this was a 3-day massacre that saw white mobs terrorize the city's black residents. So around 25 black men and women were killed, and this was sparked by two newspapers basically saying nonsense that four white women had been raped by black men, and that this was somehow linked to some black owned saloons on Decatur Street. And so after this, the Atlanta's white residents attacked this rising black middle class. They attacked them, they killed them. And this was the kind of thing that they were doing. So there was basically an excuse, right? Uh-huh. An excuse for white terrorism under the guise of prohibition. And this was something that sort of continued. And again, as like Lisa said, this was a nativist movement. So we're talking about lots of anti-Catholic ideologies, lots of anti-Irish, anti-French, anti-Italian, anyone who is Catholic. I mean, but this goes back for a long, long period of time. Catholics were discriminated against for a long period of time because there was for many reasons, but one being that they held a stronger association or link to the Pope than to the leader of their country. So they were always viewed as somewhat dubious because they weren't necessarily, they were more loyal to the Pope than they were to their own country. Yeah. This is not necessarily true. This is what some of the nonsense was that went along. So again, really, really, really sort of horrific ideologies. And again, this is all sort of wrapped up in this white Anglo-Saxon Protestant ideology. And this is one of the reasons why we in medieval history don't use the term Anglo-Saxon anymore, is because it's really associated with racism and white supremacy. And so, you know, we as medievalists are moving away from and getting rid of this term because of its severe racist connotations that we can kind of see again in prohibition.
Yeah, absolutely. There's all kinds of other stuff. And but on the other side of that coin too, it is also wrapped up with a lot of sort of the progressive movement and sort of early feminism at the same time. So, but again, because it's such a white movement, you don't get those women of color who were the early feminists or the progressives. They're sort of shunted off to one side because there is absolutely a huge problem with alcohol in America, you know, leading up to this. But instead of sort of solving the problem of people being overworked and, you know, despairing over, you know, things, instead of having labor laws or laws to protect women and children because one of the lines that would get sold again by sort of progressive middle class and upper class, mostly white Protestant feminists, was like, oh, we're rescuing these poor women who can't speak for themselves, whose husbands go and spend all their money on booze and who abuse them. And that was absolutely happening to some extent, but instead of solving, you know, people not having opportunity or not having any sort of legal protections for women and children, they're like, maybe we just won't have booze. That will be a whole thing.
Lisa McGurr, who's this professor of history, she wrote How Prohibition Fueled the Klan, and she talks about like the Women's Christian Temperance Union and, as I mentioned before, the Anti-Saloon League, how they sort of formed two phalanxes that had to do with this like sort of white supremacist ideology. And equally, as you said, Lisa, a lot of these feminist women that I think a lot of white women look to sort of unproblematically about how, you know, they're sort of grandmothers of this thing. Well, they were really associated with this really, really racist ideology. And so they cannot be removed from that. And they were called out about that by Black feminist women at the time. And they didn't do anything or enough about that at all. And they continued because they were so... they didn't care. I mean, to be honest, they didn't care. And so we cannot remove them from this either. And I think when we talk now about the idea of like white feminism,
Well, I was going to say about the feminism point was, I was reading an article I found on, I was reading about prohibition in Nashville because I'm from Nashville and it's more interesting to me when you, and it's an article and it had, there's a section in it talking about how the 18th and the 19th amendments work together and basically how, and I didn't understand this, so I'm going to explain it the way I understand it, but, or I'll just read it. But many women who supported the temperance movement and then prohibition, they did it for personal reasons. And a lot of times it was because they blamed alcohol for the reason why their husbands came home drunk and beat the crap out of them. So of course they don't, they're for prohibition, but they're also, supporting prohibition was also supporting the women's suffrage movement.
Absolutely.
Which I never realized. And then on the flip side, this article writes, this is also the reason why many men and women who did not support a women's right to vote is because it meant no more legal alcohol. And I was like, oh, there were women who were definitely not against suffrage. And I've always wondered why. But yeah, that was an interesting point.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, again, I think the local angles are really important because, again, going back to sort of the sort of big German immigration, a lot of them come to the Midwest and that part of the South as well. They go to Cincinnati, they go to St. Louis, they go to Milwaukee, in a large part because there are caves there. They can lager their beer under there. And, you know, a lot of these people, though, again, these are highly skilled professional brewers. These are not sort of, and again, there's a lot of classism in this too, but these are not people who have no skills. These are people who have come, who are ready to, you know, be the kind of sort of venture capitalists of their day to a certain extent. They are setting up huge businesses. And, you know, to a certain extent, because of prohibition, the city of Cincinnati, for example, like essentially destroyed their legal economy by getting rid of all of that. And so you can really argue that in some ways it never recovered. But Sarah, you're absolutely right in that it's really, you know, absolutely tied to, you know, who has power, who doesn't. Do we want to give women power or not? But yes, the 18th and 19th Amendment are inextricably linked. And I think it's important to acknowledge that and be like, a lot of these people are problematic. There's good stuff, but there's bad stuff in here too. And, you know, if you don't sort of give a nod to that, then it gets complicated. But I think to go over to Carolyn, I think you've been looking up some stuff from Texas, and that's going to be interesting. As a border state, you've got all kinds of things going on and potentially booze coming in there. I'm curious what you've discovered in the local history.
Yeah, I'm going to like read this a bit. So it said at the start of the national prohibition, the state of Texas found itself in a weird position due to geography. Like,
yes.
I mean, we're next to Mexico. So, and they said, unlike the U.S., Mexico allowed the legal sale of liquor and smugglers to capitalize on the new black market. So they sent a lot of tequila and stuff through the smugglers. And so it's a Texas law enforcement faced up against both smugglers from across Mexican border and native-born moonshiners. However, the law enforcement viewed and dealt with these groups in different ways. So
I bet they did. And that's...
Oh, yeah.
That's another interesting one. And actually, a little aside too, I don't know if anyone saw the, I forget where the American congressman was railing against all of the imported meth. And it's, you know, and he was like, before this was all local Montana, it was Montana meth. And now it's all coming in from Mexico. I was like, what are you saying? Like, did you want your local like artisanal meth? Like what are we talking about?
Yeah.
Here?
And the law is not applied equally. Like, that's why you have, like, you know, if you go to, like, Vegas and they have the mob museum and you see all, like, the mob prohibition stuff, and which is, I think, sort of like the what we all kind of think about prohibition. Yeah. We think of sort of like speakeasies and the mob and this, you know, we don't really learn about how racist or anti-immigrant or all this other things. But that's really who that they were sort of going after. They weren't, they were, right. They were certainly attacking your, you know, your small black owned businesses or your immigrant or the not even
people
immigrant
smuggling.
Idea. Yeah. Just, absolutely. Just anyone that they deemed like, you know, other is.
Right. Absolutely. And actually that's a perfect segue. So I'm going to talk a little bit and I'll probably come back to her a couple times about Mabel Willebrand, who was one of the first women to be an associate attorney general in the United States. And this is actually, if you look back, it's a sort of perfect example of what we call now the glass cliff, where they promote a woman to a job that they know is going to be a failure, because she is just essentially put in 1921, she is essentially put in to enforce the Volstead Act, which is what brings in prohibition. And she personally was like, well, this is dumb. Like, she was never in favor of prohibition, but this was her job. And so now she was trying to figure out, how do you prosecute people in this? You know, how... You know, what do you do here? And this was, you know, she started like documenting like who was the most corrupt judge, the most corrupt like local commissioner, all of these things, because she clearly understood relatively early on that this was, you know, she had been set up to fail essentially in this job. But that was one of her big points, was how come we're not, you know, actually prosecuting the big operators? We're shutting down a speakeasy. We're going after, you know, an individual woman selling booze, you know, out of her, you know, out of her back garden. So her quotation was that prosecuting speakeasies was like trying to dry up the Atlantic Ocean with a blotter. And now, again, she's not unproblematic. We're going to come back to this later, because she also sort of actively campaigns against Al Smith, who was running for president at that time. We'll come back to that. But there's, again, this sort of anti-Catholic element, but there's a twist in the end. So we will come back to her. But I think, again, let's talk a little bit more about kind of, Carolyn, what you're saying in terms of that sort of tequila coming across the border, because this is kind of, at least in people's minds, when what we'd say our modern cocktails are invented largely to, you know, disguise the taste of this right. awful bathtub gin. Now, again, to myth bust, that's a little bit overstated, but that said, this is one reason why, one, we have cocktails as a popular thing even now, and two, why women can go into bars now, because before prohibition, women did not go into bars unless yeah. they were prostitutes or saloon owners, but
yeah.
you know, respectable women, in air quotes, did not go
yeah,
to bars.
So, yeah, so this is interesting because it says, because Texas, because dry Texas was next door to what, Mexico, the borderlands developed a profitable trade for smugglers. Tequiros, translated tequila people in English, this is what this article says, purchased their alcohol legally in Mexico and transported their goods across the border to sell at a significantly higher price to a group of native bootleggers who would distribute the product. So, like, you're getting on the people that are sending it over, but you're not going to get on the people that are actually distributing the product. Like, this makes no sense. They should both be punished equally, but if you're going to punish someone, they should both be punished equally, because absolutely. These people are making a profit. Well, they're making a high profit on tequila and whatever else they were bringing across.
Yeah, tequila or tequila-like or whatever yeah. they're yeah calling it. And I think that's, and I think to mention, to bring in Wayne Wheeler, who's kind of the big bad of a lot of this, he was really the architect of some of the worst things that happened. He wrote a lot of the Volstead Act. He was a terrible, terrible, terrible person. Like, we can just say that. He has no redeeming qualities. He is literally the worst. And there are a lot of parallels, really, with, like, someone like Wayne LaPierre, because he was sort of feared by politicians in the same way that, yeah. you know, the modern NRA is, or again, sort of the larger, I would say, sort of, you know, gun movement across the U.S. And again, that same thing where it sort of went from being something reasonably sensible that, you know, for example, Hunter's supported to being this like free for all, everyone should be armed to the teeth kind of thing. There are a lot of parallels with kind of what Wayne Wheeler did, where he essentially set up this sort of bulletproof organization and no one would vote against the things he, you know, he said. So again, he got the Volstead Act through, and he was also the one responsible for making sure that there were, you know, such, you know, terrible laws that all of these people died from drinking, you know, stuff that was certainly not drinkable, and never suffered any kind of consequences as a result.
Yeah.
Is it something like 10,000 people died during
COVID? It's something like that.
Something
it is,
like that from.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Mostly from poisoned alcohol because of all this?
Exactly. And again, and it's a gamut too. It's not, you know, just, again, in air quotes, you know, sort of, it would be sort of in the press at the time, they'd be like, oh, well, these people were alcoholics anyway, and were not contributing to society, which again, is a terrible thing to say, but was not true. It could be also be the case of, you know, you someone who just gone out for one, you know, one sort of drink on the fly. That absolutely happened too, but there was no, you know, sort of no remorse, no recompense, just, and he was basically like, I'm glad they're dead, because again, he was literally the worst. So if anyone's watched any of the sort of big documentaries, I think they do a good job of, whether it's the Ken Burns one, or I enjoyed the BBC Two one from, oh God, like 20 years ago now. He is the big bad because he is the worst. And, you know, I think we shouldn't fail to point out that there were individual people driving a lot of this who were, you know, terrible. So because a lot of these people, like there will be some redeeming quality or, you know, something they were known for. And some of the stuff that they did in this period gets kind of, yes, we sort of hand wave it away, like, but they did other stuff, which again, people are complicated. So it's hard to separate some of these things, but again, it is so inextricably tied up with sort of this bit of white feminism and that bit of, you know, especially anti-Catholic, you know, sort of sentiment. But again, also, Christina, to your point, you know, disproportionately prosecuting people of color, for example, or the poor in general in the U.S. It was, you know, when they did prosecute something high profile. So, for example, when the 21 Club in New York gets raided a couple of times, it's a big story because it's unusual. It's not a big story, you know, because that was happening all the time. That's almost kind of the parallel to sort of a current Brexit story, where like right now, British people in Spain are having to leave because they've discovered they're illegal immigrants. And it's like, okay, well, that's a sort of Schadenfreude story. So same with the 21 Club, where they'd kept all of their really good booze and were selling it to their well-heeled patrons. But of course, a lot of their well-heeled patrons were also well-known political bosses, and you know, never thought this would apply to them because rules had never applied to them. So
this is actually funny. So because the Mexicans didn't have any like. The ones who were creating this were poor. They used donkeys. They trained donkeys to wait at the watering hole or at home so they could be taught to, like, smuggle the product across and then come back home. So the Border Patrol hated these donkeys because the donkeys knew exactly where to go back home. And I just think
that's fantastic.
Very interesting.
Good boys and girls.
They used donkeys. Yeah. That they used donkeys. Instead of, like, I mean, they could, according to this article, they were very poor and couldn't afford cars and trains like other people. So that's why they use donkeys. But
also, how smart is that? Like, what a good job. Like, no one's going to prosecute, you know, your donkey. This is
Like, it's kind of genius because you just send it to go to a specific place and then come back home. Like,
In fairness, I wouldn't put them past prosecuting a donkey because there was a famous case, remember, where like a pig killed a child and they took the pig to trial and then they hung it.
Did they make bacon out of it afterwards?
No, they executed it and then put it where they thought they
So they let a whole pig go to waste?
I don't know what they did with the body, to be fair, Sarah. I don't know, but I do remember that
they could have had BLTs for days.
That's hilarious.
They did put the pig on trial and the pig was executed.
We'll link this article in the show notes because it's actually very interesting and has a lot of information.
Wow, that sounds fantastic. I didn't know that about the donkeys, and I've looked into a little bit. I feel like people, again, know in air quotes a lot about sort of booze coming from Havana. Like, you know, it's very sexy to be on your boat and, you know, bringing things in from Cuba or coming across the Canadian border as well. But I think we don't talk as much about the Texas-Mexico border, which, you know, we should, because also that's where you're making all of your really interesting cocktails, frankly, like anything that's, you know, going to have tequila, that kind of thing. But again, to sort of circle back to this idea, too, that, you know, you have women going to speakeasies, women who would have never gone to a sort of typical saloon or typical bar. But I think, Sarah, you had something interesting about these different sort of classifications of drinking establishments.
So we have, you know, a bar is a bar. We know what a pub is, but they always have all those fun Wild West terms for bars, which is like saloon, tippling house, or a tavern. I think tavern is quite nice. But in the same article, it's a very good article, who was written by a friend of mine from high school, I am fairly certain. And it's talking about the difference in the definition between what a tavern, saloon, and tippling house are. And they are all defined as a place where drinkers are entertained, usually with minimal food and without overnight accommodations. And on that note, I would like to propose we stop calling it wet pubs in Ireland right now and start calling it something more exciting like tavern, saloon, and tippling house.
Here, Team Tippling House. We should get t-shirts.
Definitely Tippling House. Team Tippling House. I can't wait till the Tippling Houses are open again.
I'm going to go tipple some. Tipple.
Oh, yes. Let's tipple away. That would be phenomenal. Oh my goodness.
I love that.
Yeah, slight aside, I got some four provinces. I got a growler delivered the other day, and just to have fresh beer, it was really nice. So.
Oh, I miss a pint.
Absolutely. Although maybe we should try to make some bathtub gin sometime. Historically accurate for this episode.
Well, yeah. And again, I think a good sort of segue. So we know too that you know, here you have things like Vine Glow, which would be, you know, it's almost like a homebrew kit. You get your sort of packet of sort of grapes and your sort of packet of yeast. And it's like, oh no, never put these together. No, it will turn into wine, and that would be the worst. Do not put this in a closet where in 3 days' time you will have disgusting but drinkable wine. But it's fantastic. We'll have to link in the show notes, too, because their label was 100% explicit about this will turn into wine and get you drunk. All good. But it's interesting. I'm going to go back to Mabel Wilbrand for a minute, because she ruled that it was legal, you know, in her job as assistant attorney general. She's like, well, it's not transporting liquor, which was what was the offense. It's just telling you what might happen. And again, it's like legal in your home. So if people look up on the internet, you can absolutely find a Vine Glow advert from the 1920s where, you know, it is straight up. And of course, on the flip side of that too, we have all of these people who suddenly are getting licensed as ministers or rabbis or anything to make their rabbinical wine or sacramental wine, because that's all allowed. And there is a whole controversy over how, you know, what percentage is intoxicating. And I highly recommend Maureen Ogles, Ambitious Brew. Ooh, we love Maureen. She's great. Hi, Maureen. but there's a whole bit around, you know, it had to be 0.5% or less under the Volstead Act. But as people are trying to find loopholes and try to find sort of ways through, at a certain point, they decide that 3.2% or less is probably not intoxicating. So, and people were like, I will volunteer as tribute to test whether or not this is intoxicating. But it's a whole fascinating question when you think about sort of the near beer that a lot of breweries still made, at least the ones who continue to operate, which was mostly disgusting, although not unlike the malt tonics we talked about a few weeks ago. But it is this whole fascinating gray area in terms of what was legal and what maybe you were still making around the corner, because what's the worst that could happen? You might get fined. You know, it's it was all like, oh, you're so bad. Oh, no, don't. So there's a lot there that's, again, sort of this combination of lack of enforcement and also just, you know, what were people used to? It's fascinating to me, but yeah, Vine Glow, there you go.
on a possible positive note, and I don't know, Sarah or Carolyn, if you encountered this, some of the sources that I read kind of said that like the prohibition sort of like speakeasies and underground pubs sort of laid the foundation for like what we kind of view as a nightclub now. So they were like mixed gender and mixed race and sort of all kinds of different people would come and sort of mix and mingle. And that's sort of where we are now. And I don't know, did you two encounter that at all in your research?
No,
or
but that's interesting.
That makes complete sense to me. I mean, anytime you think about a speakeasy, it's a lot of different types of people all in one place. And it reminds me of a dive bar, you know, just a bunch of weirdos drinking.
Absolutely. But again, I think that's really, really important, because especially you have a lot of younger people or people who had returned from the First World War suddenly going out in a way that they never had before. And it's still important to emphasize, it's probably, relatively speaking, a minority, but it was just so easy to do, again, speakeasy, that, you know, people, you know, just got used to it. And in the same way that I think anyone who grew up in the States in, you know, either the 80s or 90s, like, you know, there was a guy you could buy pot from somewhere. Not suggesting, but just saying everyone knew. It's the same kind of idea. And again, it was all just sort of ridiculous that this was all not legal. But it is just fascinating. And then when we start to sort of think about what finally kind of undoes prohibition, like it's a little bit like this pandemic. Everyone's just really tired at a certain point. And it's just like, you know what? This is dumb. So yeah,
I was going to say a lot of the stuff we're talking about, like people getting fined and they're just like, wink, wink, nudge, nudge, pay the fine, reminds me a lot of some things that are happening right now. So it's
Shebeens.
Parallels.
Like it reminds me of the Shebeens, which really look like bars that people have sort of made. And what is that? What is that phrase like for a rich person? A fine is just the cost to pay.
Yeah,
cost to play. Yeah. And so, yeah. But the other thing I was just going to say, Sarah, when you went to Vegas, did you go to the Mob Museum? Do you remember the Prohibition exhibition?
I actually didn't get a chance to go to that one. I'm really jealous that you've gone. I've seen people on YouTube do vlogs of it, and it looks really cool. Like they even have like a hidden speakeasy bar in there, right? Did you do that part?
I don't think we we got stuck in the part where you can like measure yourself like behind bars and all that other, oh my gosh. And then the Prohibition exhibition, oh my goodness, where it has these pictures of women and where they used to hide like flasks and stuff. I'll put them up on Twitter. Actually, I'll probably just tweet them when this episode goes back on Friday, but so cool.
I probably could have taken some notes if I had known years ago back in college when you had to sneak Ziploc bags of Jack Daniels into Neyland Stadium for a football game because you couldn't drink on campus. Like, what's a better way to get this in here?
Yeah,
that's hilarious.
And speaking of friends, we should all go. There are speakeasies in Dublin that we should go to in the
Blind Pig. That one's really nice.
Oh, good cocktails. So before, though, we get just into sort of cocktails, I know we're sort of running out of time a little bit. I'll talk a little bit about the presidential election of 1928. A couple reasons for this. Again, we have a lot of work, if you like, from Mabel Willebrand. Not in a good way. Again, she's a very interesting person. Again, problematic, but also does some good. But again, background, 1928. Al Smith gets the Democratic nomination for president. He's the first Catholic to get the nomination for president. And it does not go well for reasons. Now, but again, fun aside, my dad was born in 1928. He was named after Al Smith because his parents were so excited that one of their people, if you like, was running for president. But things got a little racist and a little anti-Catholic, just a little bit. So first of all, the KKK was the basic sort of last man standing, if you like. It was like, no, America needs to be dry, if you needed another reason to think that these people are garbage. They were like absolutely out there, like, let's burn crosses so that he can't be president. But there was this whole big bit. I'm going to read a quotation because it's super awful, but again, people should know about this. So one of the sort of big sort of old school WASPy folk, if you like, was all out there saying, well, you don't want to vote for Al Smith because he courts, and again, quoting here, the Italians, the Sicilians, the Poles, and the Russian Jews. That kind has given us a stomach ache. We have been unable to assimilate such people in our national life, so we shut the door on them. But Smith says, give me that kind of people. He wants the kind of dirty people you find today on the sidewalks of New York. So again, not dissimilar from a lot of current rhetoric. There's always someone who's the persona non grata with the political class. But this is what's interesting. Again, going back to Mabel Willebrand, is she really, even though she found this sort of personally distasteful to an extent, still campaigned for Hoover? Because she thought, well, if I get, the Republican guy nominated, I can move up in the world. I can get, a better job. I could be the Attorney General of the United States. And Hoover was duly elected and not Al Smith, because again, like you were saying, Christina was like, no, he'll take orders from the Pope. It'll be the worst. So because of that, largely, he did not win. Hoover, of course, did. And that went well, as we all know. But as soon as Hoover got elected, Mabel Willebrand reaches out to him and is like, so, how about, a sweet political appointment? And he was all new phone who dis, nothing, gave her absolutely fuck all, nothing at all. So she eventually stopped working in politics and went out to start to help like the Screen Actors Guild and other people in LA. But there's a sort of fascinating quote from one of her friends who said, if Mabel had worn trousers, she could have been president. So let that sink in there. But again, the last irony, the sort of twist in the story, in later life, she became a Catholic to sort of, be like, my bad, I guess. But it's just a fascinating, you can look at sort of individual people, again, how they do interesting things and they're problematic, but also, because on the one hand, just following orders is not the best, way forward, but it's fascinating that she did at least kind of try to say this doesn't make sense and tried to sort of work, within the system, in air quotes. Didn't work, but it's an interesting, again, she's a really interesting person to follow. I'm kind of surprised there isn't more sort of scholarship on her. There are bits and pieces, again, kind of more within legal scholarship than anything else, but she's a really interesting person, inextricably tied to Prohibition and kind of how this all played out. But it's fascinating that she kind of did all the right things, but because she was a woman, didn't work out for her. So
Yeah, I think you put up an interesting point that a lot of the rhetoric that we see in this is like very similar to the anti-immigration rhetoric that we see now. Like, for example, one of the things I read is that I think it was the Women's Christian Temperance Union actually said they wanted people who were immigrants who violated prohibition to be sent to their respective the country that they came from, which is something that I think we see now as well, in sort of rhetoric, but which is just awful. But like, I guess like on a happier note, Carolyn, have you been to a speakeasy?
Not yet. My friend and I, I think it's called Midnight Cowboy. My friend and I were talking about it, and so we're gonna go one day.
Is that in Austin?
Yes.
I literally read about it right before we started this. I was looking for pictures of speakeasies, and it came up as one of the best ones.
There's another one near the Capitol that's pretty good, so we'll have to go check out a few. I have not been to one, so it's on my list of things to do now that
I've been to Cafe du Nord in San Francisco. Is an old school speakeasy, but now you just go in it. But it's a super cool space, and again, they obviously celebrate that now as part of their, you know, part of their heritage, but it's a fascinating place. And again, I think we will eventually do a whole episode just around sort of cocktails and their evolution and some of the gross ones you got in the 18th century, which have nothing to do with this. But I yes, Sarah, for those who are just listening, Sarah's got a cool book. We'll also do tiki drinks at some point as well. But again, it's so important that we get that. So we'll do just a couple minutes. I know we're almost sort of at time here on just kind of what happened next, because it completely destroyed the beer industry and it completely destroyed effectively the then sort of nascent wine growing, in industry in California, especially. But, you know, I was trying to think like of the pre-prohibition breweries that are still around. I could only count sort of 10, and a lot of them are really only around still as a brand, really less than an actual going concern, like a Pabst or something like that. Obviously you do have your Yinglings and your Anchor, things like that. Again, they're not the only ones, obviously Anheuser-Busch, but it, you know, again, to sort of completely take that out of the economy or out of the legal economy, like imagine shooting yourself in the foot that much, like, oh my God. And of course it does eventually come back, but it's interesting how different tastes are, where you've gone from really having a wide variety of beer styles, or relatively wide, at least you had a lot of ales, you had different kinds of lagers, to just having one pale lager, you know, and nothing else. And again, a bit of an irony that the sort of German pale lager is what reigned supreme after that was what people had been railing against for decades. So it's a weird one. So I don't know. And then you don't even get, like, I'm trying to think, like, Carolyn, I guess Shiner Bock comes back, later. And that's one of your first popular dark lagers, really.
That's on my list of places to go to. They don't do weekend tours, which is kind of annoying. Or they didn't. They probably still don't. But yeah. And St. Arnold's Brewing in Houston has been around for a long time as well. So those two are the ones that pop in my head that have been around for a long time.
Yeah, absolutely. But again, it's a completely changed landscape afterwards. And so you have all these, you have all this consolidation. That's a whole other story. We won't get too much into it, but it's again, it's interesting how different tastes were, and how again you had now this taste for cocktails, and how you do have a slightly more egalitarian approach to, again, men and women going out, having some, not 100%, but having a little bit more diversity in kind of who you associate with and what that looks like. Again, that's its own sort of big deep dive. But I don't know, again, Christina, what's your kind of biggest takeaway about, like, what happened with all this?
My biggest takeaway is that Prohibition was racist and anti-immigrant and anti-Semitic as fuck. And we don't learn about that in the education system in the US. Like, that is information that when I was growing up, you had to seek out. And I think that's a little messed up. Well, I mean, that's pretty much par for the course, right? There's so much of our history that we just sort of gloss over. But I think from my sources, I think the fact that this is sort of where, like, modern nightclubs come from, where it's like mixed gender and mixed race. And I thought that was really interesting. that some of the sources that I read had kind of mentioned. I think that was really interesting. And of course, like, as Sarah and Carolyn and I, you know, sort of when we mentioned speakeasies, I see like everyone just kind of lights up. Like I like, and even if it's not the historical reality of what it was, yeah. I like the sort of modern idea and the modern take on a speakeasy. I think that's sort of wonderful. I don't know, Sarah, do you have anything sort of to add to that?
The vibes, I was going to say, the speakeasy vibes, like it behind me, my virtual background, it's just dark, it's romantic, you got the velvet seats, it's just open seat, I don't know, I just, the music, yeah. I just really like them, so yeah, I know, I completely agree, I can see how speakeasies led to the modern nightclub, and I think my biggest takeaway from this is what I would say to anybody who wants to learn more about Prohibition is realizing it's complex, super complex.
Absolutely.
Like you say, Lisa, people are complicated. They're complicated now. And I think when you look back and you see somebody, what they did, you have to think about the context in which the time that they lived, and that's what the best that they could do at the time. I don't know. I think it's super complicated.
It is. Yeah. How about you, Carolyn?
Yeah. No. Yeah. I mean, again, in school, we just learned this is Prohibition, this is what it was, and then you move on to something else. So it's very interesting to like kind of deep dive into it and learn about, I learned a lot about, a little bit more about Texas and the Prohibition and learning about other states and just Prohibition in general, because I didn't know that it was, as Sarah said, as complex as it.
I just love your donkeys, Carolyn, like that little
fact. I love that fact.
That is a great story. I love it. Oh, that's fantastic. So again, we'll probably leave it there. So I want to say thank you again for listening. Thank you to Christina, Carolyn, and Sarah. Again, I'm Lisa. So remember, like, subscribe. You can follow the Beer Ladies podcast on @BeerLadiesPod on Twitter or @BeerLadiesPodcast on Instagram. Obviously, you know, you can subscribe to us everywhere. On YouTube, again, if you do subscribe on YouTube, we would be very, very happy. We can finally get a vanity URL, and we are so vain. We want that vanity URL. So we really appreciate it if you can. But of course, wherever you get your podcasts, we are there. So thank you for listening, and we will catch you again next week. Bye.
Bye.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.